Good morning. Good morning, counsel, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The case, the next case to be heard is A20-0139, Teresa Williams, personal representative of the state of Kristen Nicole Keither, respondent versus William Keither, appellant. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel for, you can see the clock there on the screen. If you can't, wave. Okay, so the clock is on the screen. It's a little bit of glare, but I hopefully it's legible to you. So we are ready to go. Counsel for appellant, you are first up, of course, and if you could please, when you're ready, state your name and a party you represent for the record.
Good morning, Your Honors. Darren Knight, representing the appellant, William M. Keither.
And go ahead, Mr. Knight. Thank you.
Did you hear that I just said that I represent? Did you hear? I'm sorry.
Yes, we heard you. So go ahead with your argument. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. May it please the court, the essence of the trial court's order, which we're appealing, is focused on the share purchase agreement in this case. The trial court and the respondent in the appeal relied on the alleged failure to follow the transfer procedure set forth in the share purchase agreement. Paragraphs 37 through 47 of the trial court's order detailed the procedures set forth that the lack of compliance with said procedures in the share purchase agreement. So the remaining conclusions of the trial court order all follow from the court's analysis and conclusion.
Mr. Knight?
Yes.
If we're dealing with the stock purchase agreement, and we've had a copy of that and have read it,
yes.
Are you arguing or positing that the terms of the stock purchase agreement are ambiguous?
No,
we're not arguing that. See you. You got to go on video again and say, on video, we can't see you. Sorry.
Okay. No, Your Honor, I'm not arguing that the terms are ambiguous. But the trial court's order.
If the terms are unambiguous, under what authority do you claim that you were able to assign stock different from the explicit terms of the stock purchase agreement?
We're arguing, Your Honor, that this is analogous to almost a Pierce the Corporate Veil case. We think it's, rely upon a hyper-technical argument, the two parties, the only two shareholders, Your Honor, were William Keither, the appellant, and his sister, and they own the corporation. So I think you could argue that notice and consent was given and constructive notice and actual notice was provided. I mean, if we're gonna rely-
wait a minute, Mr. Knight. There isn't, as far as my review of the record, there wasn't any proceeding to set aside the corporate status. Has there ever been such a proceeding?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
And if that's the case, how do we, as a reviewing court, pierce the corporate veil? Because you're acting us to say, well, what happened was a sham. They didn't need to comply with that. Don't we first need to have an underlying action to determine whether, in fact, the corporation was in good standing and followed all of the appropriate rules?
Your Honor, I think I'd turn around that analysis and say that the sham alleged or the lack of corporate formalities is what the court is relying upon, and the corporate formalities under the were followed in a sufficient manner. There were only two shareholders, and they own the company. I mean, if we're going to follow this analysis, we would have single member LLCs and corporations invalidate or unwind actions all over the state, all over the country, every day.
Isn't that the whole point of having rules that you are to abide by, both for income tax purposes as well as how an entity such as a corporation is treated? What would be the purpose of those rules?
Well, again, I would go to there's the Victoria Elevator case and different cases that we cited in our brief that you would not unwind. It would be improper and completely impractical to unwind corporate and LLC and limited partnership actions due to such a hyper-technical analysis, when we have two shareholders that agreed in writing to what they did.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Do you agree that is dispositive of the entire action, that the sole issue is the interpretation that we place or don't place in the stock purchase agreement? Is that the issue, that the sole issue before us?
I believe so, because I don't believe there was ever, well, there's standing issues, but
well,
Yes, we have standing issues, but yes, Your Honor, I think this court could find that the share purchase agreement was adequately followed. And again, I mean, at some level, and I don't mean to be too strong with the language, it's an absurdity to unwind actions like this and grant summary judgment when you have two shareholders owning their own corporation. Nobody disputes there was a written agreement between them. Nobody disputes that it was invoked. Nobody disputes that they were only two shareholders. Nobody disputes what they did. And they were the only two shareholders of their own company. If you relied on this to grant summary judgment, then you could unwind closings every day of the week in Minnesota. I mean, Your Honor, I do transactional work where we'll have parties that are not represented, and you know, the title standards now, they'll sell a building and they'll provide an operating agreement, but they won't provide certificates of authority or minutes or resolutions of what they did at closing, and they'll still sign a deed. And so, you know, if they're not represented,
you know,
by
Mr. Knight, I agree with you, and I certainly would not be the person to sort of, you know, want to ignore reality. But I did have one question that you referenced in your statement. You said, you know, that would ignore the other written agreement. What written agreement are you talking about?
There was a stock pledge agreement and a note between the parties, and they signed off on the transfer of Kristen's shares. And I don't think the court and the trial court it acknowledges that in the trial court order. And so back to where I began, everything stems from that in this case. So if you follow that analysis, therefore if you don't void the actions that they took, which we believe they properly took, if you don't void those actions, then the rest of the trial court order, it follows from that. Everything stems from that. And that gets to the standing issues. I mean, I've already stated that arguably you could assert the two share.
Mr. Knight, are you saying if we, and I understand your argument, one question I had is, are you suggesting that if we do what the respondent wants us to do, which is, you know, say that the share purchase agreement trumps, as a result of that, there's going to be some sort of unjust enrichment to your client or unfair result, or, you know, Mr. Respondent's counsel is, respondent's client is going to get some sort of double recovery that was never contemplated by the parties or, you know, the family. Is that the essence of your argument?
I'm a little confused by your question, Your Honor. I apologize.
So if we follow, what I'm trying to find out is, if we don't do what you want us to do, which is you want us to ignore the share purchase agreement and follow the other documents, if we don't do that, are you saying that there's going to be some sort of huge windfall to respondent's client as a result of this? You know, she's going to get, that the respondent's client is going to get money that no one envisioned the client getting as a result of this?
I guess what I would say, Your Honor, the whole case rests on this. So, I mean, they won the case at summary judgment based on this, and they should not have. And so
as a result of that, is respondent's client getting a windfall? I mean, if we do it the way you did, then it was supposed to be even Steven. But now, by doing what court did, respondent's client is going to get an extra $1 million.
I don't know that there's going to be in a windfall, but they're attempting to collect on a judgment. So I guess I don't know if there's
going to be a judgment that she would, that client would not be able to collect on otherwise.
Well, they wouldn't have the judgment otherwise, but for this erroneous order.
Okay. And if they collect on that judgment, how much is the respondent's client going to get? How much money?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know how collectible the defendant did, the appellant is. I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that.
Well, what would the amount of money be?
Well, the judgment is for $730,000, I believe. And that's the number that they was awarded. I'm sorry if I'm not adequately answering the, you know. Okay.
Follow up on this, and it's not quite in the case, but it's a follow-on question to Judge Connolly's question. So as I understand it, your argument is that the decedent and then now the personal representative had no entitlement to the sum of money that came in from the transaction that essentially was, who is the party that they got the 1. Whatever million from, right? I've forgotten the name, my apologies. But it was, basically, oh, go ahead.
It passed through their father and the Keithser Distribution Company. So
okay, but they settled up on a note, right? And essentially yes. Then that large sum of money comes in, half of it goes to respondent, half of it goes to your client, right? Under the judgment. I mean, that's what the district court essentially is holding. Sure. Your client shouldn't have taken it all. Instead, it should have been split with the other party. And then your argument is, I think that the personal representative had no entitlement to it because it had already, you know, sold the stock under the stock purchase agreement, for which, and this is my question, she was entitled to $380,000. I don't really see this being an issue, but my question is, there was only payment, I think, alleged of $30,000 on that. I'm wondering, what about that? Is that just a non-issue in the case? It's not a question, it seems, pragmatically between the sum of money awarded and zero. It seems like you're arguing that she's entitled only to the $380,000, which was the stock purchase agreement. Is that right?
I think you're correct, Your Honor. Yes. And that was payments going forward that she was to receive, and then she tragically died.
And so was that part of the, I mean, both parties moved for summary, agreed that this is a case that should be resolved on summary judgment, I believe, right? Cross motions, yes. Or at least agreed to on a motion. But was that an issue in it? Did I just sort of miss it as to whether it's not half of the amount paid, it's in fact just the obligation under the stock purchase agreement?
That has been the position of the appellant. I not at the summary judgment. He handled that on his own, Your Honor. So, but yes, that's been his position. That the benefit of the bargain she received was she wanted payments over time. She didn't want a lump sum payment and between brother and sister. And that's what she wanted. And that was going to be her benefit of the bargain. She had an agreement. And by
those,
the way,
those payment obligations survived her, I guess is my point. Is the difference of the windfall that the other party is getting, in your view, the difference between the $380,000 purchase price and the $700,000 judgment?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that goes to a key issue in the case, because the standing that would be conferred to the personal representative would be exactly what you're saying. They could collect on that. They don't have standing to bring conversion and unjust enrichment claims, which arguably are conversion's a tort claim. Unjust enrichment is arguably a tort, analogous to a tort claim. They're not direct claims under the standing laws in Minnesota, the way we read our citations. So
if the decedent hadn't died and these exact events had taken place and she realized, hey, I didn't get half of my money, she would have had standing, no, to bring a claim for conversion. I agree. I understand that you would say, It's a frivolous claim or not a meritorious claim, but she would have had standing to make that claim. It's just a question. And if she would, why wouldn't her personal representative?
Well, if you look at some of the cases we studied, including the Philip Morris case, by the way, Your Honors, I apologize. I don't see the clock. How much time do I have left? Is there a clock?
You might not be in a gallery view. I don't know if you're seeing all.
I'm in gallery view, but I don't see the clock anywhere. I just don't
know. You have 2 minutes and 37 seconds left.
Okay, I'll try to go fast. The Philip Morris case, in some of the other cases we cite, in that particular case, a standing was not conferred for tort claims. It was brought by the Attorney General of the State of Minnesota, Mr. Humphrey, and on behalf of Blue Cross, because there was not a direct injury. It was considered too tangential, I think, if you read that case. In some of the other cases we cited, that would be our argument. It needs to be a direct injury at the time. So in order to confer standing on the personal representative, I think would be exactly what you stated, Your Honor. It would have to be standing to pursue that note and that pledge agreement, which was the benefit of the bargain that Kristen Keithser had with her brother. And it would not be standing to bring up conjured up claims, you know, after she's passed away, where, you know, there's no way to prove up these adjustment and conversion claims, arguably. And so I think that's why the standing should be narrowed to a direct, not an indirect injury, but an injury in fact that is direct at the time of Kristen's passing. We cited another case that is analogous, where it cites where there was a bankruptcy where the only claims allowed forward were the claims at the time of the bankruptcy, not claims subsequent to the bankruptcy. I don't think, I'm not trying to remember which case that was. I think it was the Worm versus John Deere, I'm not sure. And so I think some of the citations that you know, the Security Bank and Trust case also supports the appellant, as does the Involve versus Independent School District 704 case. And the entire argument of the other side goes to the core issue that was brought up by the prior judge. The first questions of me go back to this technical argument about the share purchase agreement. We don't think it's practical to decide the case based on that. That's why we think this should be brought back down to trial, to the trial of these issues that you just raised. And to decide this case based on simply that analysis of the share purchase agreement.
I mean, go to trial, as Judge Smith pointed out, you both agreed this shouldn't go to trial and that somebody should win on the merit as a matter of law.
Because someone brings a summary judgment motion doesn't mean that they don't necessarily believe there should be, you know, they shouldn't go to trial if they don't prevail on the summary judgment motion.
Never mind.
Yeah. I mean, sorry, Your Honor, but I mean, I think that it doesn't preclude the appellant from still having a trial on the issues simply because he brought a summary judgment motion, you know, because
yes, if we conclude that summary judgment was improperly granted, you would be entitled to a trial. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's all we would be seeking in this case. And then they would have to, you know, then the respondent would have to prove the conversion and unjust enrichment claims, which we believe would be very difficult at the trial court level, because the benefit of the bargain again goes back to the agreement between these two, the brother and sister that own this corporation.
Counsel, so, your time has expired. If you want to take a moment to wrap up, and you will have time for rebuttal as well.
I think you guys have asked very good questions and got right to the point. And I had a lot more to cover, but I believe that the questions in the back and forth addressed the main issues that are before us. So thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And again, you'll have time for rebuttal. Let's just pause a moment before we switch zone and see why it is that you can't. Do you see all the faces on the screen of all the participants?
I do, Your Honor, but I don't for some reason see the clock.
How many squares or rectangles do you see on the screen, your screen?
Oh, you know what? I had to hit an arrow. Now I see the clock. It was my mistake.
Okay. No, that's okay.
I had to hit an arrow to make it go broader, but now I see everybody. If I click the clock, I don't see everybody's face, but I do see the clock and I can click back. I can click back and forth.
Or else are you in, when you look in the upper right, there's a view and there's speaker view or there's gallery view. Like gallery view is the one that gives you, it's all a whole bunch of little dots and it would give you all on one page.
I'm in gallery view, and if I hit full screen, I still don't have a clock unless I click the arrow. But I'm
okay.
Fine. I'm sorry.
Are you gonna? If you'll be okay on your end, we're good.
I'll be fine on rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. So you can go ahead and mute now, and then we'll go to Mr. Sellers again. If you could start with your name and the party you represent, and then take off from there.
Good morning, Judge Smith, Judge Work, and Judge Connolly. May it please the court. My name is Jacob Sellers. I represent the respondent in this case, Teresa Williams, in her capacity as personal representative of her decedent daughter, Kristen Keither. There are two issues before this court in this appeal. Both are legal issues. The first issue is whether or not respondent had standing to assert claims on behalf of the state. And the second is whether or not the district court properly interpreted and applied the stock purchase agreement to the facts of the case before her. Before jumping into that, I want to address some of the questions that the panel raised, which I think are very pertinent and go to the heart of this issue. The first is the issue of this windfall. If appellant's position is accepted, does that result in a windfall to my client? Absolutely not. The bare fact of the matter is that under any scenario, whether you follow the stock purchase agreement or the alleged promissory note, the decedent was never paid. So essentially the argument that I think counsel made boils down to, we can deny your ownership interest and we can take your shares and not pay you for it. Well, under any scenario—
But isn't the promissory note, it's a different amount and just simply a different claim, right? I mean, the issue presented seems to be about the payment with the holder of the, I'm really apologize. I don't remember the company's name that held the promissory note relative to the KDC or the corporation. But I mean, the promissory note for $380,000 is just a simply another claim that has a different total sum that she would, the estate would ostensibly be entitled to.
Correct, Your Honor. We have not pursued a claim under that promissory note. I think it's important for this court to keep in mind how this came, this case came about.
Well, before Mr. Sellers, I'm sorry, your screen says Jacob. Mr. Sellers, before you get into that, and this is a little bit of a just a side issue, you know, I realize that appellant counsel filed bankruptcy and the proceedings were delayed for some time. That didn't affect any of the stock transfers or any of the judgment amounts entered, did it?
No, it did not, Your Honor.
In so fact, it was simply just a reason for a delay in the proceedings.
Correct. A year and a half, almost 2 year delay.
And then the next question I have for you is, of course, appellant is asserting that Kristen transferred her shares of stock through a promissory note. Was there ever any evidence of that produced, or was that simply just a bald allegation?
Your Honor, you raise a very good important, and I'd like to address that. And so the manner in which this case arose, at the time the decedent died, there were absolutely, the only records on file, corporate records, evidence that she owned 49% of the shares in this company. Those were the only corporate records, that's what exists. The respondent, as personal representative, made demands for the corporate records and on the appellant here, including any evidence of any transfer of ownership. None was produced. At the time the decedent died, what was known is she owned 49% of the stock in the company. A few months later, appellant, acting as the president of the company, extracted corporate assets to the tune of $1.8 million and dispersed those assets to himself individually, which was contrary to the articles of incorporation of the company. If you look at docket entry 87 at page 15, it's the articles of incorporation of the company, and that article, that provision says that in the event there's a liquidation of the assets of the company, which here occurred because the appellant took all the assets of the company out and then rendered it insolvent, that provision says that the assets are supposed to be dispersed to the owners of the shares in accordance with their pro rata interest in the company. We sued this case out because, as it stood, those were the facts. Respondent was, based on the corporate records, 49% owner. Funds were distributed and it wasn't accounted for. It was only in the course of discovery that appellant came forward with what he contended was a promissory note and a pledge agreement that, to his mind, effectuated some sort of transfer of shares. So to answer your question specifically, no, there are no documents, evidence, an assignment to sell of anything.
Well, okay, but
right, so when you say,
go ahead, Judge, sorry.
When you say he came forward with, you mean the allegation that there wasn't any physical documentation of that claim or any documentation to support that claim?
There was an allegation that there was an amount due from the company to her secured by a security pledge agreement. There was no evidence of a transfer of shares.
But wait a second. Let me hold there, because we here, of course, are on a it's a legal question, right? Whether there's any disputed facts on this, and I am looking at the stock pledge agreement and the and then more importantly, I think the assignment separate from certificate dated January 1, 2014, signed by Kristen Keither, that says for value received, I transfer onto William Keither, 18,071 shares of common stock. So I'm seeing documents that appear to be on their face, the sale of her stock to Mr. Keither on January 1, 2014. I appreciate that there are complaints about when they were produced and there's suspicion around their validity, et cetera, but the district court decided not to that was not a basis for decision. It's even assuming this is a valid signed by her transfer of her stock, it's invalid because it did not comply with the 2002 or 4 stock purchase agreement, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think you proved the point. What you're looking at is an assignment certificate from an individual to an individual. What they've alleged is that she transferred her shares to the company.
And so, and are you saying then that there's no, that the stock, because I think in, I agree, actually, that was confusing to me as well. So I'm glad that you reminded me of that. I was like, because it seems to be the stock pledge agreement, is that the word? Or stock purchase agreement from January 1, 2014 between, says, is that also to the company or to the?
To the company, to the company as well, Your Honor. And so, if I may, what the district court was presented with is evidence of, as of the date of the deceit and her ownership, in response to summary judgment, we were presented with various iterations of an alleged transfer, both from her to the company, her to the individual. And the argument and the analysis before the district court was, there is a very specific manner set forth in this stock purchase agreement that governs the manner, the only and the sole manner in which interest in this company can be transferred.
Right, I understand that, but just so I understand what the documents show, and so there's the one signed by, there are a couple signed by Ms. Keither, and I'm gonna assume that those are actually her signature and so on because the district court did. So it's not getting into the validity of that. Are you saying that there's no, that the stock purchase agreement and the assignment that I read, et cetera, all reference or relate to sales to the Mr. Williams and not sales to the corporation of herself?
No, what I was answering, the question I was trying to answer, Your Honor, was a very specific question of whether or not there was evidence of a sale.
These look to me like evidence of a sale, yes. But a sale to whom? Are they evidence of?
Well, as you pointed out, there's varying accounts. There's documents that show a sale from both. Well, show a purported transfer from the company, from Kristen to the company, and from Kristen to appellant himself.
And which one is from Kristen to the company?
That's the promissory note and the pledge agreement.
Okay, so.
The very specific.
Should this all, so we're assuming that she did, in fact, I think the district court assumed that she did, in fact, sign documents that purported to sell her stock to the company before her death. And our even position, so, it's invalid because those did not comply with the, you know, all sums have to be with a stock purchase agreement. We get to the question of, well, this is between brother and sister. They only two shareholders. They're making an agreement between each other. It's not to protect anyone else. Why then should that be invalidated if it was in fact invalid?
Your Honor, the very specific question I was trying to answer is yes. The question I was asked is there an evidence of a transfer of ownership and property? There's not. There's a promissory note and there's a pledge agreement. A promissory note evidences a debt owed to a person. A pledge agreement secures that note. To transfer property, whether it's stock, real estate, you name it, there needs to be a purchase agreement, there needs to be a bill of sale, there needs to be an assignment from a certificate of service, there has to be a document with a grant or a conveyance of an ownership interest. So the question that I was answering was that very specific question is there a document that evidences a transfer of ownership? And the answer is no. There's a document that evidences a debt due, but for what? Who knows? And there certainly is no document where anyone conveyed their right title interest in that agreement. Now, the issue before the district court, we made these points. The issue before the district court was there are varying interpretations and varying theories, as Your Honor has pointed out, as to what happened here. Our position to the court was, you don't need to reach that issue, Judge. There is a stock purchase agreement between all the relevant parties that are in this case. Those parties agreed very specifically, if a transfer did not follow those provisions, it was void ab initio. They weren't requisite. They weren't mandatory. It said if they weren't filed, the transaction is null and void. Now, before a district court in a contract interpretation case, we all know this. The intent is to enforce to determine what the party's intent is and enforce that intent. That intent is revealed specifically from the written instrument. We don't need to look to three variations of who she transferred it to. Was it the company? Was it him individually? The document tells us what has to be done. Now, when the contract is unambiguous, as they clearly admit, the only thing before the district court was they've alleged there's no transfer. They say she owns it. They rebutted that. They said, no, she doesn't. She transferred it. They bear the burden of proving that a valid transfer occurred. They've used the words invalidate a million times. We're not trying to.
What I heard is that they agreed that they didn't follow the stock purchase agreement. That's what I understand that they agree they did not follow it, but what Mr. Knight is arguing is that, well, who cares? We could do what we want because these were just brother and sister.
I agree, Judge Werke, and that's the position. Now, you'll notice that the sole argument of both.
Yeah, but you would say that's wrong, right? I mean, you know.
Well, of course,
Judge. The whole purpose of having these, you know, as we all know, not every family gets along as well as we would all hope. And, you know, so the way to make sure things are done correctly when you have closely held corporations, particularly family held, is to specifically outline how things are done so that, you know, that's how they're going to be done and that's how everybody knows it. So that's what we should be looking at. Isn't that right?
You're correct, Judge Connolly. We look at the terms of the document. That evidences the party's intent. Our job, the district court's now job, is not to rewrite it. It's not to modify it. It's not to say, well, you had to comply with this and not that. The document is a document. The issue of law is, what does the contract say? Was it followed? And that was our argument. And they admitted that, yeah, it says that. Yeah, we didn't follow it. Who cares? I want to address one issue briefly in the 1 minute that I have remaining here is, the entire argument here is focused on, well, it was just these, you know, nefarious or these technicalities, these notice requirements that weren't complied with. But that's not true. In addition to various notice requirements that had to be complied with, the most important requirement to effect valid transfer set forth in that SPA is that the purchase price has to be paid at closing in cash. That undisputedly did not happen. It's never happened. So this is not a case where we're saying, oh, it's just brother and sister and they were lazy and they didn't, you know, follow the requisite procedure. This is clearly a case where this document set forth what you had to do. One of those requirements is essentially the entire basis of this case is if there is a transfer of an interest, the payment has to be made at the time of closing. And that was not complied with. In summary, I haven't addressed the standing issues. I think our brief speaks well on that. The issue before this court is whether or not the district court erred in interpreting the contract. There's only one way to read the contract. They admit it's clear. They admit everything that the district court said. It's not the job of the district court, and it's not our job to rewrite or to modify that agreement. It's our job to interpret what the party's intent was from that agreement and to apply those terms as written. We think the district court did exactly that, and we think she should be reaffirmed in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Knight, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. A couple things. I don't think I'll need the whole 5 minutes. First of all, this is not a who cares situation. I don't think it's a matter of being cavalier or just disregarding corporate formalities or the share purchase agreement. I think that you have to remember this is that share purchase agreement came from the estate of the father of William, the appellant, and his sister, and it carried forward to them. They became the only two shareholders of this company.
Mr. Knight, I find it interesting that apparently the terms of the stock purchase agreement were very important to the parties when they obtained the uncle's shares. You acknowledge you complied with the terms of the SPA when the uncle's shares were transferred.
Well, that there was estate issues going on, Your Honor, and that was part of that. But then it came forward to the sister and the brother, who became the only two shareholders of the company.
But doesn't the very conduct of your client in dealing with David, with his uncle, as far as acquiring the shares, show that he is aware of the formalities and the requirements?
Okay, but the formalities and the requirements arguably were not followed by Kristen. Who's the injured party here? I mean, the Keither Distribution Company has no standing to bring any claims. Kristen voluntarily entered into this agreement. A little background, the appellant has informed me that Kristen wanted to receive $380,000. That's a lot of money over time. She did not want a lump sum. She had issues in her life, and she did not want a big pot of money because she was worried about how she was going to handle it.
Does the evidence indicate she ever got that stream of income?
She received payments until she passed away. Yes. And she was going to receive payments under the note. They were also going to buy and manage rental properties together, which is part of the prolonged litigation that's been going on with the personal representative, which is the respondent in this case, has brought three different cases against Mr. Keither over a period of years, seeking the assets of the estate, in essence, of their father, of William and Kristen. And so Kristen did not want a big chunk of money. She wanted payments over time. And if anybody had standing, okay, if you follow the share purchase agreement, who didn't give consent? And who didn't, so did the appellant? I mean, it's even noted in the court's order that the appellant, you know, didn't decline or consent to the transfer of Kristen. I mean, well, the appellant, you know, by the way, I think it's pretty clear the documentation, you know, again, this was done by these two together. I don't think they had lawyer help as far as I know. I don't know at the time, but there was a stock pledge agreement, a promissory note, an assignment of certificate, I believe, back to the company, which would leave the appellant as the only shareholder. And then, so the stock was in fact conveyed back to the company. And I believe that was documented. I think that's in the record at the trial court level. And then she was to receive payments over time pursuant to this note.
Mr. Sellers' argument is, yes, there's that documentation, but there's no documentation that it was ever carried out. What's your response to that, Mr. Knight?
Well, again, if you've got an assignment of a stock certificate and if you've got a promissory note and payments have been made, it's carrying out. You're carrying forward and you're paying out on the note. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How much cash does the record indicate in total how much money she got on the note?
She received, I believe, $15,000 in payments. And I'm trying to remember.
Did the note say she should get?
$7,500 a month, I believe.
For how long?
I don't have that term in front of me, Your Honor. I apologize. But it was
so
up
it
until.
Sounds like it was even up under until your scenario of the facts. She got 15, but she was entitled under the length of the note and the income stream to get
$380,000.
Okay.
$380,000.
Can you speak? I'm sorry, Judge Conley, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Can you speak to what was a question for me when I was looking at this? Is the documents, the stock purchase agreement, that I'm looking at from January 1, 2014 was not to the company. Can you speak to opposing counsel? What evidence is there that there was a stock sale, not to Mr. Keither, but to the company?
Well, and Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have all those documents in front of me. I thought there was an assignment of the certificate back to the company. She assigned her shares back to the company. That's what my client has informed me of. And again, I wasn't at the trial court summary judgment motion, but that's what I was informed. And I believe I've seen that document. I don't have it with me. So I believe there was an assignment of the stock, and it was referenced by Mr. Sellers and earlier. And also there again, there's the note and the stock pledge agreement.
Right. I see an assignment where it says, for value received, Kristen Keither hereby assigns, transfers, and sets unto Mr. William Keither 18,000 shares, et cetera. I don't know, and maybe I missed it. It could well be. I found the documentation been helpful to get it actually in the addendum, the key documents that we should be looking at, because it wasn't that clear to me when I was looking for the stock pledge agreement et cetera, which ones you're specifically relying on. And you just, I just ran you out of time. So I'm going to give you time to wrap up and answer my question too.
I would rely on that. Perhaps there was some confusion whether they were signing to the appellant or signing to the corporation. But I think the intent was to, in essence, make Williams the sole shareholder and her to receive an income stream over time pursuant to the note and the pledge agreement. And the intent was to assign the stock.
Okay. Would you like to wrap up?
I think I just appreciate the time of your honors today and the judges. And this was an interesting experience. It's the first time I've done an appeal. And I thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for your briefing, for your arguments. And although it is awkward at some level to do appeals like this, it's quite easy to pay attention to them. And I find it was a very engaged argument. So hopefully it wasn't too distracting to do it in this manner. So thank you both. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time.